Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about looking at the proton in depth. When I say in depth, finding out about what's actually inside the proton. And the way we've done it is several ways, but the end of it I'm going to explain what happens when you hold a proton up pretty much like a pinata and fire a high-speed bullet into it. And this is what the Americans have done at the various linear accelerators, getting a high-speed electron, positron, firing at very high speed at the proton where it doesn't have a hope and it just bursts. Now, does it burst like a billiard ball? Does it burst like a watermelon? Does it burst like a water balloon? What does it burst like and what does it tell? So it turns out that you can do a lot of forensic ballistics when you fire the bejesus. You've got, I can't work out what's in something, I can't work out how this clock goes. I'll hit it with a bazooka, so to speak, and just see it fly apart. And what you do is you take heaps of freeze frame pictures of this falling apart in different methods, just getting it out. I want to work out how a French period clock works, so I get a million of them and just line bazookas up at them. But that's unfortunately what we've got to do. So I have to walk back in to introduce the proton. Why I'm interested in the proton is a description of the atom and quantum physics, which I want to work towards. But I've had to sort of start off with the proton and the nucleus, and in general the overall picture that you have of the nucleus being a big sort of marble bag of protons and neutrons together is sort of a thought bubble, 1936 thought bubble, which was quickly extinguished except lived on in school textbooks. So they have this idea that neutrons and protons are these hard spheres and they're so strong that you can't crush them, and they're not quantum mechanical particles, they're classical particles, like classical marbles in a marble bag, and they're really strong and they're held together strong, and the strong force is they're strong, but they're stronger than the strong force because they don't get crushed by the strong force. This bizarro thing, and that the fact that the idea that you can actually get a bag of marbles, hit it with a stick, and it will ring like a musical instrument. It obviously goes like that. Whereas a proton, you can actually hit with a stick, and it will ring. It's got these energy levels in it, and there's all these things which come to say this is not the model, but we have to sidestep it. So the first thing that I've done in terms of looking at different problems, looking at discussion of the microwave background, discussion of solar physics, our physics and astrophysics, quantum physics, is come up with a scale, a fixed scale that we're going to think about. And the scale is a trillion. So if you say I'm going to look at anything a trillion times, blows things up by a factor of a million million, the proton will sit in your hand as a ball bearing, and a little millimeter plus-ish, millimeter and a half ball bearing will sit in your hand, and that's the size of a proton. It's spanned by a million million. That's a good way to think of it. Now, the sun, contracted by a million million, which is a trillion, will also be a ball bearing. It's in your hand. And if you do that a second time, shrink things by a million million, a trillion, and do it a trillion times smaller, the galaxy will sit in your hand as a ball bearing. That's a double trillion. So it's a very useful thing. And in that second scale, the entire universe is 800 meters side to side. So that gives you those trillion scales. So that's something I've worked on to come up here. And so we're going down rather than shrinking things by a billion, we're blowing it up by a trillion. Get to that scale. To quote Rutherford, the nucleus is a fly in a cathedral. That is a millimetre in 52 metres average radius. And we have to... I've got a lot of work to do on the electron. Studying the proton. Now, what I've done is I've poo-pooed the liquid drop model that's taught in school, the hard spheres, and said, look, they're not hard spheres. They're made up of these quantum particles. We need quantum chromodynamics rather than electrodynamics. The colour is a sort of three-symmetry charge. And if it's got a different quantum number, it can exist through the same point in space. And you have that helium nucleus. The school way is four little balls of different colours, or red and blue. The quantum way, the Saxon Biggs, I think, is the way they sit through each other in a space and in a helium. And the two protons and the two neutrons sit through each other in space. And if you wanted to add another neutron there, you'd have to... The neutron, because it's got the same quantum number, can't have the same spin number. It's just like an electron. It's actually got a division. If you look at atomic spectra and look at nuclear spectra from one to the other in terms of radiation and stuff like that, they look pretty much identically the same. That is, that you can have a like in our space, the production of ozone produces metastable oxygen. Metastable oxygen hangs around for a few hours, creating a glow at an evening or a nighttime glow, this green and orange glow. And similarly, cobalt has a similar reason. It is only allowed to have two photon transitions. It's symmetry-wise. So in the cobalt nucleus, cobalt 60, I think it is, cobalt 60, does that make sense? Yeah, I think it would be cobalt 60. It doesn't have hard ball bearings, and the ball bearings are shifted a certain way, and that can't go through. It is quantized. When I say quantized, I actually do mean quantized. Quantum numbers. Then it's got discrete energy levels of different symmetries. So that one is excited. It's when cobalt is made up, irradiated with neutrons. So you've got a nuclear reactor and some cobalt in it. And, oh, crap. And you just flood it with neutrons, and the cobalt absorbs the neutrons. It absorbs the neutron, but it it's got a two-level, a two-photon decay, a forbidden two-photon decay. So the beauty of cobalt is that it's got a very long lifetime for something which is only a gamma emitter, but it emits two simultaneous gamma rays. It's two... a two-photon gamma rays. It's a sort of double brightness. The point here is that the nucleus is nothing like the liquid drop model from that you're taught in school, and it's actually just a blob which goes along the place. The proton. So I had a little interruption there, trying to get back onto it for you. For you, you didn't hear interruption at all, but I was interrupted for a minute or so looking at things. So the proton is a hadron, and it's a hadron because it's got quarks in it, And it's a baryon because it's got three quarks into it. So bary means heavy, hadron means thick, coming across. It's got three quarks in it, and the quarks have to be of red, green, and blue, so they add together, the colours add to be white. That was a way of doing, I suppose, matrix algebra, you know, colour algebra. It was sort of like a, I don't know what you'd call it, in astronomy, it's an asterism. That's where you imagine a shape of a dog or something like that, and then you can see, you can remember the positions of stars. So this is something like a, picking up another piece of unrelated knowledge and using that. So the actual quarks aren't those colours, we're just using that method of logic and thinking. So remember that logic and thinking, we'll forget all of that and we're going to call it there. So the quarks are not in actual fact different colours, it's just that we have just borrowed that thinking machinery. We say, oh, that's that thinking machinery, have you got that right? Well, if you bring it over here you can use it, but it has got no corresponding in there, obviously you don't have colours. And the quarks are fundamental particles like electrons, and they're formed ultimately by two light waves, two energy interacting with space and constructing the space such that so the energy flows into some space, sits there, and is locked forever. Well, it's locked for a long time in these quarks. I don't think anyone thinks that quarks going to decay. Electrons can't decay. There's nothing that an electron can decay into, and a quark can't decay. Quarks are fundamental particles, and so they have, by the method of creation, in order to be made from energy, they have an angular momentum. A fundamental angular momentum. Fundamental in that there is no mechanism within the quark for it to produce this property. It's a fundamental property. That is, when it's fundamental, we say it's fundamental. We don't have an equation, and we don't have a mechanism for it behind there. If it does have a mechanism, it's not fundamental. That's what. So we mean fundamental reads, in sort of medieval terms, magic. It has a magical property of angular momentum. So the three quarks have spin up, spin down of a half. They're fermions, but there's two spin ups and one spin down. That their angular momentum is what is it? The angular momentum is half a Planck's constant. So Planck's constant is happens to have units of mass times velocity times a distance. So it just happens to have several formulations. The angular momentum is also an energy action. This is from 19th century physics. The energy action is the integral of energy over time. So it's got joule seconds or angular momentum. This is both the unit of angular momentum. But a quark itself has got no physical extent. There is the quark wave function goes right down. There's no piece of grit, which is in actual fact a little quark, and the rest of its properties extend. It's got no ability to have parts. It has got no parts to spin. So it's got the property of spin, but it actually doesn't spin. And this is the entire problem that people say, oh, look, physics explains everything. It explains everything until you reach some maths which you can't explain, and then if you can't understand the maths, you don't have an option of saying, but there is a process and it's not the maths. It's either, as far as you're concerned, magic, or there's some maths in it. So quarks itself, I suppose the individual ones have SU2 symmetry, but special unitary symmetry, the three of them together have an SU3 symmetry, and the SU3 symmetry, describing the SU3 symmetry, has the colour charge. So it's got SU2 charge, but SU3 RGB. So it's a 3 symmetry in it. So each quark weighs about 1% of the mass. The actual coupling of the individual quark with the Higgs field, which gives its mass, is only 1 or between 1 and 10%. The rest of it is involved with the energy field between the quarks. So in terms of in special relativity, there is no difference between energy and mass. So the intensity of your energy field is in your gluon field between them. So if I've got a neutron and a proton, they exchange a meson, which is a quark and antiquark. This is a spinless quark and antiquark. So it's a quark has spin up, the other one has spin down. There, a meson goes across, it has no net spin, and it exchanges, it can exchange or resonate these quarks. Now, the interesting thing is that there's now within quarks together, or those inside the meson and the quarks, three quarks inside the proton, they have a force, and the force is by a gauge boson. That is, the strong field has the property of the charge. Now, the interesting thing is that the field itself is attracted to each other. So if you can imagine what would happen if I had two bits of light and the light were attracted to each other, the lights are photons and the two photons were attracted to each other, you can imagine that your light would go in and your light would actually shrink down. So if instead of my search beam, my searchlight beam would come out and the light would be attracted to each other. Gluons can be attracted to each other. Gluons themselves feel the strong force. So this is sort of a mind-bending thing. So your gluon is a vibration in the strong force, as your photon is a vibration in your strong force. A photon has a spin of 0, 1 or minus 1. So a photon, a travelling photon, its photon will have a spin. If I fire a photon, it can have spin 1 for right circularly polarised, or for left circularly polarised, it can have spin minus 1. And how can a, how can a oscillation have spin? Spin means, really refers to the angular momentum it carries. And how does it can carry angular momentum? Well, it can carry angular momentum because the actual field itself is not rotating. So you've got all these symmetries. So space itself is not rotating. If space, in order to carry a angular momentum, must carry a spin, has to stop rotating. It has to have its rotational symmetry broken. So the interesting thing is that the space is lost its rotational symmetry. That is, space is not rotation invariant. So if I spin my office chair, my legs fly out, and it's not the fact. And then if I have my entire room spinning with me, so I'm in a spinning frame of reference, my legs will still fly out. And so your particles themselves have to lose that symmetry, and in order to gain that other symmetry, your particles lose that symmetry. So similarly, your protons, your photons are massless. Your gluons, I believe, are also massless. The other gauge bosons up, the Z vector bosons and the omega W bosons, which I really have to do for the weak force, they do have mass, which is pretty amazing. So not only are they attracted to each other, but they are also interact with the Higgs field. So that's enough to blow your brain. But your gluons attract each other, and your gluons, your quarks, are attracted to each other. Yeah, that's why they stick. Look, you have to say they have to be attracted to each other, and attracted to each other, that there is this strong force. Why it doesn't completely implode is the same reason why the hydrogen atom doesn't completely implode. It's a wave function. You could say it's uncertainty. It is fully as imploded as it possibly is. A quantum particle. It has that. You are actually measuring the field strength there. So your hydrogen atom. The hydrogen has actually fallen into the nuclear, into the proton. Okay, people say, well, what happens if the electron falls into the proton? The electron has fallen into the centre of the proton, except it's much bigger. It's sort of like this, you're giving a toddler a huge teddy bear and a field. The toddler has got the whole teddy bear, and it's huge, it's big around them. So for your quarks, they're actually, they're potentially, if there was a free quark, it'd probably be quite large, I would expect. So the thing is that if you add things with three masses together, you get something about a third or ninth the size, or 27th of the size coming together. So it must, the quark wave functions must cancel as you go out, or actual quark is really strongly bound. So the size of something going out is the size of its confinement. So it's confined there. Now the important thing is that your quarks are bound. So you've got your three quarks, your red, green, blue, two ups and a down for your proton. So your proton's got a symbol P plus, or you can have the same quarks but in excited isospin state, and they'd be called the delta plus. Or you can have three up quarks together in the delta plus plus, or the delta naught, which is the two downs and an up, but an excited space. So your deltas are your excited states, the first excited states of your protons and neutrons going on with no strangeness. So protons and neutrons have got no strangeness in it. They've only got ups and downs. And ups and if you just use ups and downs to make things up, you can make these deltas. So they're not fundamental particles. It's like hydrogen. You can have the same hydrogen, but it can be excited hydrogen that can decay and produce lights similar to a proton. And it's got these components in it. Now the first dead giveaway was that the proton and the neutron have a magnetic moment. Now, a magnetic moment is simply the strength, a magnetic moment is the strength of a magnet in, joules per Tesla. That is, you can see a magnet by how violently it will spin to align with the field, how much energy it will give off. That's a measure of the strength. And neutrons and protons will also have this thing where they will spin. Well, they actually can't rotate. This is the important thing, is that proton and neutron are SU2 symmetry, so they can't physically. If I get a proton, I cannot pick it up. It's got nothing distinguishable about it. It is a blob. It, you can't put a mark on it. You can't get something smaller to put a mark on it. You can't pick it up and grab it and spin it. It changes symmetry. It sort of almost pulls itself inside out to be aligned or counter-aligned to the prevailing magnetic field. But nonetheless, it has, in that step, it does have a measurable magnetic moment. And a magnetic moment is calculated by two things. One is the energy it gives off to actually flip it. So if it's got crap magnetic moment, it's easy to flip. If it's got a strong magnetic moment, it's different to do. But you can also calculate the magnetic moment by the circular current times the area. Now, the circulating current, no matter what the area, gives you the B field. That's a from Ampere's law and the Biot-Savart law. So if I've got something inside a circle, the B in times that circle is proportional to the current, regardless of the area. The area can be anything, but it's, if I've got an amp in a an amp going around a big loop, it will still produce produce that magnetic field. Now, so this is strange, that if I have a loop of wire and the magnetic field, it doesn't really matter how big that loop is. The thing is, the flux, therefore the total flux, is the area times the current for it. Now, obviously, when you're making a you're paying for the wire, it's much better to have a smaller field, because it's a smaller amount of wire that you need, but you get the same field there is. So it's B is the current times the area. And so what happens is that a proton has a positive magnetic moment and a neutron has a negative magnetic moment, about 2/3 of it pointing the opposite direction. But a neutron is not neutral. It's got a distribution of positive and negative charges inside it. So immediately the neutron, we now know, has components in it, and the components must be distributed, that if it's the spin is such that its magnetic moment means that the two down quarks, which is minus 1/3, must have a larger area in it, because each one of those, the ups and the downs, have a quark, a spin in it. And the gluons don't carry any charge. The gluons are not particles, they're not quark particles. So quark is like an electron. It's not moving anywhere. It is a stationary wave. So an electron is a stationary wave in the electron field. So quark is a stationary, self-confined, and it holds charge. So a quark has a colour, is a knot of the field, which is knotted a particular colour. Now, why we tend to say it's knotted a particular colour is that that's what we've, since we identify something still, we say, well, we're going to call that a particular colour. Now, the gluons are the oscillations of the field, and they attract each other going across, and the gluons are not... So if I want to glue a red to a green quark, at the end of the day, I want to be able to have that red, that transaction take, well, I suppose, red wants to add redness and subtract greenness from a green quark, and then add greenness and subtract redness from the quark it's going to. You want the two quarks to resonate and change colour, I suppose. And so the gluons can be of the form red anti-red and green anti-green. So you can fire the green quark and actually convert a red to a green, and when that hits it, converts across. Now, it's not that simple. You've got a 3x3, three, I suppose it's antimatter. It's not antimatter, because there's no matter in a quark, but it's anti-colour, anti-charge, or negative. I suppose it's antimatter. I'm just trying to think of it. There's anti. You can have the anti, anti. You've got three positive and three anti. 3x3 is 9. One of the symmetries of the of those 9x9, 3x3 doesn't work. So you've got 8 possible gluons. I'm just channeling this. You've got 8 possible gluons. And I'm slowly working my way through. This sounds confusing, but this is the actual story. So you've got 8 possible types of gluons. So you've got 3 quarks in a proton, 2 up, which is plus 2/3, 4/3, +4/3 of charge, -1/3 for the down quark, which gives you a net charge of 1. And then you have that having a net, it has a magnetic moment, which indicates some coupling between the angular momentum and the charge. So the charge looks as though it's spinning. There's this fundamental magnetic field field in with it. Now, all this is, if you've got, if you imagine an atom that was able to be solved on a whiteboard, a proton has 3 quarks, and these 3 quarks are interacting with a soup of gluons, massless gluons, which have, of themselves, there's a lot of energy associated with it. And so the gluons contribute 90% of the mass of the proton. And this is, like, the mass of it is quite a lot to look at. And just even keeping in your or my tiny brain the... some of the assembled facts is a lot, and you know, I'm struggling back from a slightly shattered, smashed brain, so I'm slowly trying to get this up. So you've got these 3 quarks, and it, you know, dare I say, the people say, well, look, when we just have huge amounts of difficulty just calculating anything to more than or 90% is a good, on a good day, if we get 95%, we're really bloody happy. And these are just fundamental particles, and the fundamental physical constants going through. It is very hard to work things out. So the electron, very good. They can, which is a single fundamental particle, and it's got one vertex. Now, so what I say, it's what I call it's a Feynman-Diamond diagram vertex. So the electron itself, its calculation of it requires that the electron exists in a soup of antiparticles coming into itself. And once we do that, we can do some good calculations. The complexity of the proton with the three quarks, the gluons which attract each other and intense and create a glue field. So if you can imagine the glue, if you can imagine a glue which increases the attraction of it. The idea is that people have theoretically thought that I can actually make just a pure glue ball. This is, and let's try and give you some idea. I can get gluons without, because they attract each other, I can actually potentially make gluons with no quarks whatsoever. That's a theoretical aspect of it. So, so you've got quarks, and then these are going around, and then they interact with antiparticles, which tend to slow them down, pull them out, and I think the antiparticles will also increase the attraction. So you've got this actual maelstrom of attraction. So you've got this thing of the three quarks, say tiny pips, and the rest of this incredible, these rays between these quarks, which attract each other and generate more of them. So I don't know whether gluons would actually beget more gluons, but at the end of the day, I think that's what you could say, that it's 90% glue and 90% gluons and 10% quarks in your proton. It's and the proton, the energy, that mass that you see there is stationary energy. Well, that's what mass is, stationary energy. Now, the end of this is that what happens when you fire something at it? Well, when you fire an electron at high speed at it, and it destroys the momentum and the energy, creates these flux vortexes of gluons, and it produces these jets. So when you hit it, you tend to produce, and I don't know whether there's always three jets, there's generally a number of jets coming out with particles associated with it, and they can count the number of particles with it and actually start to calculate it. And so it's more, so it's like more firing if you can imagine a blueberry with a BB gun. There's a squirt of juice. There's a few pips in there, some quarks in there, but then there's also a whole lot of gluons. Gluons, flux tubes go to so much first, and then they stretch, and they have so much energy associated with it, they pull out more particles in it. And so, although you don't see it, you see downstream these jets, and the fundamental, another way of thinking of what a jet of a particle is, that if I blew something up, it would scatter in all directions. But the fact that it's gluing itself together, that the particles come out and the particles are then attracted to each other, then they focus in these jets. So the jets that you see from your particle accelerator experiments tell you very much about the interaction of these boson particles, just pulling processes together. So that's one way to look at it. So as we're getting in summary, the preferred scale is 1 to a trillion. At 1 to a trillion, a femtometer is a millimeter. So you can imagine a 1 to a trillion scale, a proton is that scale. That's something given to you. A proton has not got a hard surface like the Bohr liquid drop model. The liquid drop model of all these little spheres together can't possibly be right. And it's completely stupid for a number of reasons. Number of reasons, one is that they would, you know, can you imagine that would lose energy. You wouldn't have any discrete energies with it. You can imagine your bag of marbles and move it around, it would make a lot of sounds. The other thing is that there's no force that we can say which would repel a neutron. I've seen people with the Kawa potential and all that type of stuff, and shown it at school, but that's just complete almost like Soviet propaganda, because there's some Briggs in the quantum mechanical treatment, and the ability for this to produce lines. So these things, a proton does not have a beginning or an end. It doesn't have a surface on it. It's unlike a ball bearing. It's the size of a ball bearing, but it's unlike a ball bearing. It doesn't have a distinctive surface to it. Then it's inside. You can strike it. You can actually raise it to higher energy levels inside it, like the delta. And then when you fire at it, you produce these jets which show inside the gluon. So a proton's made up of, say, 10% quarks. In terms of mass, if you had to pick the things out separately, you could say, all right, strong force, I could freeze the strong force. I could take the quarks out, and that would be 10%, and 90% of it would be this heavy energy glue. And the gluon says 8 types of gluons to come across, and it's quite distressing for people who I really think you have to do calculations with quantum mechanics to say to understand your selection of red, blue and green are just the first convenient ones that you come into when you first enter, but the transactional ones are real big combinations of it. So if you look at the actual compositions of gluons in terms of the red and anti-red versions of it, combinations of it, you attempted to think that you know, what's the difference between that and a meson? A meson's got two quarks in it. The gluon just has the colour vibration. It's got the name of the colour. It's how it vibrates in it. I just really wonder what an anti-blue vibration is myself. You know, what an actual factor is inside a gluon. So I hope that's helped. But that's my level of understanding at the moment. And you can see it's a long distance from proton as a ball bearing. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.